So we've begun to look at the book of Judges, and so far we've looked at three of the 13 judges that are spoken about in the book. Then the main one that we've looked at so far is Ehud, the left-handed judge. We spoke about him last week. But before him, of course, there was Othniel. Othniel was Caleb's nephew. And after Ehud, we mentioned very briefly last week, Shamgar. He's the man who's mentioned there in the very last verse of chapter 3. This man who killed, 600 Philistines. Well, he did it with an ox goad, with a pointy stick, basically. And yet he was able to kill 600 of these enemies of God's people. So I want to look this week at Deborah, and I want to begin by making some opening remarks. I want to say some things. So that's the first point then. Here are these things that we need to say at the beginning. There's a number of things we need to say. First of all, let's talk a bit about oddities. There have already been, I suppose, one or two odd things in this book already. But when we come to the next episode, then there are a few more. First of all, we only read chapter 4. We could have gone on to read chapter 5. Now, if you know the book of Judges, you know that the two chapters are both about the same thing. They're both about Deborah the judge. The difference is that the first chapter is really speaking in prose then. And again, if you've got a Bible like mine, you can see just by looking at the page that chapter 5 has been set out as poetry. And if you look at the beginning of the chapter, Judges chapter 5, you see it begins, "On that day, Deborah and Barak, son of Abinoam, sang this song." It's a song. It's in verse. And it needs to be read then as poetry. It's a poem celebrating the great victory that is spoken about in chapter 4. And there are some things that come out in chapter 5 that don't really come out in chapter 4. So that's the first thing then, that there's these two different chapters about the same thing. And then secondly, this fourth judge now is a woman. She's the only woman, the only female. And she's described in verse 4 of chapter 4 as Deborah, a prophet. I suppose you'd say prophetess in days gone by, but they want us to say prophet now. So she was a prophetess, a prophet. And she was the wife of Lapidoth. And we're told that she was leading or judging Israel at that particular time. And verse 5 tells us that she was holding court under what became known as the Palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Israelites went up to her to have their disputes decided. Now that sounds, doesn't it, more like a judge than anything we've heard so far, or I think anything we hear subsequently for that matter. This is the way we usually understand what a judge is, and perhaps the other judges acted in this way as well, but it's only here that we read of this sort of thing. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is that although the judge that God raises up is clearly Deborah, the person who actually leads Israel into battle at this time is this man, Barak. We're tempted, I suppose, then to say, well, or some of us perhaps, if we're men, we say, there's a man at last. This is the way it should be. But just as we're about to say that, of course, the whole story is not just about Deborah and about Barak, but in a very pointed way, the victory, and in this case we're talking about the death of Sisera, is brought about not by Barak or by any other man, but it's brought about by a woman. That's the point. It's a woman then who brings about this victory, a woman called Jael. It's always difficult to say that name, isn't it? I always wanted to say Jael or something like that, but Jael. Let's say Jael. Okay, so there's some oddities in this particular story. And then secondly, let's talk a bit about feminism. Feminism. It's well known that males, men dominate in the Bible stories. However, from time to time, women do take the lead, and there's often, I think if you look at it carefully, there's a sort of an undercurrent of teaching in the Bible that points to the fact that it is often the women who outshine the men. There are lots of examples. You think of further on in the Bible, you know the story of Nabal and Abigail. Now Nabal, well, the name means fool, and he's a complete fool. He's a complete washer. But his wife Abigail, she is a wonderful woman, a wonderful picture of wisdom. In this book, then, you've got the story of Deborah. Further on, you get the story of Samson's parents, Manoah, and his wife. She's not even named, you see, but she is clearly streets ahead of that man, as is so often the case with women, not just in the Bible, but in general. And so we ought to say that there's not a hint in the Bible that we should think of women as inferior to men. That's from the pit, that idea. And although the normal order is, yes, men first, and then women, men are to lead, and women then are to submit. That is the normal order, but it's not always the order. And there's no reason then for us to be disappointed at things we find in the scripture concerning men and women. And then the third thing here is the matter of storytelling. So oddities, feminism, storytelling. We've already noticed, I think, that in telling his story then, the writer of this book, he can, if he wants to, pare things down to the bare essentials so that we focus on the right thing. And we see it here again in the story of Deborah, particularly in chapter 4 that we're looking at. I've thought a lot about the matter of storytelling over the years. I remember many years ago one teacher of preachers saying that if you want to be a good preacher, then a good way of practicing is tell stories to your kids. Sit down, you know, get one of these storybooks out, or make them up out of your head. Tell stories to your kids. Or if you haven't got kids, then find somebody else's kids you can tell stories to. Telling stories is not as easy as it looks. I say this because I'm not, by nature, I'm not a great storyteller. It took me a while to work that out, but that's the case. I try and improve, try and make it more interesting, but it's not something that comes naturally. My father-in-law is a great storyteller, as many of you have heard him preach, and one of the things that makes him a good preacher then is he's a good storyteller. And I'll tell you his secret for that in a moment. But it's one of the things then that young preachers need to learn to do. My own father was not, he was all right as a storyteller, but there were certain kinks in his, you see, my father's technique then was to, you want to, you know, when you're telling your story, you want to connect with the audience. And sometimes my father would spend far too long on this bit, you know. He'd want you to know where a place was or who a person was. And it's good to try and, you know, find some sort of connection before you begin a story, but you really don't want to take too long over it. So, you know, my dad would say, he'd say something like, you know that patch of waste ground behind the old cinema? And you'd say, which cinema, Dad? Which one do you mean? And he'd say, you know, the one at the top of Commercial Street. And he'd say, well, where's Commercial Street? I don't know the name of names of the streets in the part of town you're talking about. And so, you know, you'd struggle then to get some sort of link. And I must confess, sometimes you'd be tempted, you know, he'd say, yes, yeah, I know where you mean, or I know who you mean, even though you didn't really know where he meant or where he was talking about, because he just wanted to, you know, cut to the chase and find out what this story was about. And sometimes the connection would be quite lame. I remember one time my dad went all around the house, explained this. He said, well, the man I'm talking about, this is his cousin. I think, well, yeah, great, okay, it's his cousin. Right, we've got some connection there. Now, when my father-in-law tells a story, he gets on with it. And somehow he's able just to give the essential facts. He gets the minor details wrong sometimes, but it doesn't really matter if you get minor details wrong. You've got to get the story. The story is the thing. It's the story that matters, not the details. Now I'm saying all this because if you read through Judges chapter 4, then you'll see that that's how the writer proceeds here. All the characters then, Jabin, Sisera, Deborah, Barak, Jael, they're all introduced really briefly, even abruptly sometimes, aren't they? And there's no time wasted on any detail in this story. And he doesn't even give you a moral. You know, you come to the end of the chapter and he doesn't say, "I'm therefore, this is what we need to..." He doesn't do that. It is in there, there is a moral in there, but he doesn't seem to take any time over that at all. Now the only snag with this is that the more you think about this chapter, I don't know how often you've thought about this chapter, perhaps you don't know it at all, or perhaps you've read it a few times and you start scratching your head then as you think about it. You've got lots of questions, and that is, I suppose, one of the snags in being like that. Particularly this woman, Jael. She's pretty treacherous, isn't she? She's pretty sneaky. Really, when you think about it, why is that then? Why is she? And she's commended. They celebrate her in the next chapter. How come that's in there? Well, that's something to think about. And then, just one or two more things by way of introduction. Patterns. This is one of the things that I think scholars have given a little bit more thought to over the years. You know, when you look at a chapter like this, it's very easy to think it's just sort of been thrown together, really. This is just what happened. And he's told the story and there isn't that much skill in it. But if you look at it very carefully, then you'll notice certain things. You can divide this chapter up into about 7 parts. Okay? So if you take the first part as being the first 3 verses, in those 3 verses, you're really reading about the oppression of Israel. It's Israel that's under the kosh. It's Israel then that's suffering. And then when you come to the end of the chapter, verses 23 and 24, it's about Jabin of Canaan being subdued then, being brought down by the Israelites. And if you take the second part then and the penultimate part, you'll notice that in both places there's an emphasis on what? A woman. It's a woman, isn't it? So first of all, it's Deborah. She's the focus of verses 4 to 9. And then secondly, Jael. Jael is the focus in verses 17 to 22. And then parts 3 and 5, they both talk about the same thing. They both talk about Barak and about Sisera. In verses 10 to 13, both of them are summoning troops. So verse 10, Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. Verse 13, Sisera summoned from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River all his men. And in verses 2nd part of verse 14 to 16, both of them go down then. Verse 14, the second part. So Barak went down Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And then at the end of verse 15, Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. Now, the interesting thing about all this is that means to say that the very heart of what this man has written is the first part of verse 14. Right at the center of this, in the first part of verse 14, we read how Deborah said to Barak, "Go. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you?" And you know, when you see that word "Lord" in capital letters, that's God's name, Yahweh. That's the covenant God of the scriptures. And so it's important that we highlight the fact that it's the work of the covenant God. That's what it's about, this chapter. That is what makes the difference. And if you don't, you may not remember anything else I say this evening, that's possible. But do remember this, that it's about God. God is at the very heart of this chapter. He's at the center of it all. He is the one who brings about the good things that happen. And then there are lots of other things we could mention. There's a sort of word pairing going on. Dale Ralph Davis draws attention to this, and he calls the writer a first-rate wordsmith. I won't labour this, but just to show you what I mean. If you look at verse 2, see, in verse 2 you've got, so the Lord sold them. The Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan, for and so on. And then if you go to verse 9, now you won't get this actually in the NIV, you'll get this in the ESV, but you won't get it in the NIV without me pointing it out to you. But in verse 9 you've got, for the Lord will deliver, and it's really the word to sell, to deliver, to sell. The Lord will deliver, the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of woman. So the idea of selling someone, delivering someone, that idea is there in verse 2 and in verse 9. Or go to verses 6 and 7. Go, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. And then verse 7, I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River. And again, another pairing of words. Or take verse 7 and verse 14, just one more now. Verse 7, give him and give him into your hands. God is going to give him into your hands. And then the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. It's there again. And there are lots of examples of that sort of thing. And then also in the first part of the story, you've got these three references to the Israelites, the sons of Israel. It's talking about the sons of Israel. And then when you come to the end of the chapter, then it's talking about Jabin, king of Canaan. And there are lots of these matchups like that. So oddities, patterns, feminism, I forgot what the other thing was, but those are by way of introduction. And so secondly then, I want you to notice the repeated pattern that we have in this chapter of evil doing, oppression, and crying out for help. And again, I want us to think about this. Is that sort of pattern going on in our lives? Are you repeating that pattern in your life? Evil doing, oppression, crying out. So the opening verses of the chapter now then, they're typical of Judges, aren't they? We've seen this already, I think. Once more we read here that, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord now that Ehud was dead. You see, once Ehud died, I mean, they went, what was it, for 80 years? And all was well, but then when Ehud died, they went back to their old ways. And too often people wander away from the truth once the pressure to do right has been removed. Somebody dies, somebody moves on to some other place, and so then it comes to an end. And so the Lord then, as before, sold them into the hands of enemies. This time it was this man Jabin, king of Canaan. He reigned in Hazor. Hazor is about 10 miles northwest then of the Sea of Galilee. It's up there in the north of the country. And then there's a mention also of Sisera, the commander of his army. He was based in Harosheth Hagoyim then, Harosheth of the Gentiles. We don't know exactly where that was, but it sounds like it was somewhere up again in the north, in the Galilee area. And it goes on then that because he had 900 chariots fitted with iron and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for a period of 20 years then, they did, as they did again and again in the time of the judges, they cried to the Lord for help. So here they are, once again, they're crying to the Lord. And we've suggested that that doesn't imply repentance. They weren't really turning from their sins, but they were distressed and they were concerned about the situation in which they found themselves, and at least they were crying then to the Lord. And so once again we're saying, turn from evil. Don't go down the evil path. Don't do the wrong thing. If you do, then trouble is likely to come upon you. If trouble does come, well, do cry out to the Lord. Don't wait for trouble to come. Turn to the Lord now, while it's all going well. But when trouble comes, Do cry out to the Lord, because if you do seek the Lord in one way or another, there will be an answer to your prayers. So that's the second thing I want to say then. Notice the repeated pattern of evil doing, oppression, and crying out for help. And just think about whether you repeat that pattern in your life and ask the Lord to help you to break out of that pattern if it's there. And then the third thing is to hear God's call and to expect provisos. I think that's probably the best word. You know that word, proviso? Expect provisos then if you show reluctance. So hear God's call and expect provisos if you show reluctance. You see, in response to this cry of the people then, the Lord sends them a saviour, then he sends them another judge. And as we suggested, it gets a bit complicated this time round. You see, in verse 4, we read that Deborah, a prophet then, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time, and she held court under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel. This was in the hill country of Ephraim, in the central part of the country. And the Israelites went up to her to have their disputes decided. Now, it's not that often that we read about women prophets in the Bible, prophetesses, but we do read about them. There's Deborah, of course. Can you think of others? Moses' sister, Miriam. She's described as a prophet or a prophetess. During the time of Jeremiah, there was a woman called Huldah. She was a prophetess. And when you come to the New Testament, there's a reference in Luke, isn't there, to Anna. Anna, the prophet or prophetess who was always at the temple. And it would seem that during that New Testament period then, when they had the Old Testament, but they didn't have the New Testament and God was giving prophecies, that those prophecies, it seems anyway, came not only to men, but also to women. Your young men and your young women will prophesy. And that is what seemed to happen. Now, in a similar way today, there are situations where a woman may be reading the scriptures publicly. I think that is something that from time to time may occur. And there are times when women preach, not when men are present. They preach to other women, they preach to children, but they are involved in something that is of a prophetic sort. And here Deborah, of course, is not only a prophet, but she's also a judge, just as women may take on various roles in the state, and also then in the church and in the family. Although you know, women are not to be husbands, and they're not to be elders in the church. I think the New Testament makes that very clear. Now, in verse 6 and verse 7, we read that Deborah sent for Barak, the son of Abinoam. He was from Kadesh in Naphtali. And that was about, well, there was a Kadesh about 12 miles north of Hazor. And that's probably the Kadesh that's being spoken about here. And so this man, Barak, he's called by Deborah. And she says to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun." Zebulun was a neighbor of Naphtali. "And lead them up to Mount Tabor. And I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the Kishon River and give him into your hands." It was not thought appropriate for a woman to lead the people into battle, certainly not alone. And that's been the general view through history, that that women shouldn't do that, although from time to time there have been women who've led troops into battle, and from next year it will be possible in the British Army. The British Army have changed their policy, and women will be able to fight on the front line from next year. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. Despite Deborah's summons then, Barak says to her, this is verse 8 now, he says, "If you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go." Now, he sounds like a bit of a wimp, doesn't he? I think we have to say that. I don't know why he wants Deborah to be with him. You think, well, it sounds like a lack of faith, doesn't it? And yet, I think we should be slow to say it's a lack of faith. Why? Well, when you get to the New Testament and you read Hebrews 11, amongst the men listed there as examples of faith is Barak. Barak is an example of faith to us. So I think we need to be careful. The reply then to Barak is in verse 9. Certainly I will go with you, said Deborah. But because of the course that you're taking, because of the way you're going about this then, the honor will not be yours. For the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. And so this is the prophecy that lies at the heart of what happens here. And it is important because it underlines that it's God, isn't it? God who's going to bring about this victory, not Deborah or Barak or anyone else. And until the actual denouement, of course, of this whole thing, it isn't really clear from the prophecy how it's going to be fulfilled. I mean, how is a woman going to bring about this victory? And yet it clearly is fulfilled then in a believable and yet in a rather strange way, I suppose, as well. So I think it is difficult, isn't it, to enter into Barak's thinking here. But one is tempted to say that reluctance to do God's will clearly lead to shame in some way. We can expect to be shamed if we go about things in that way. If we're not wholehearted in our commitment and in our obedience, then we can expect God to shame us. But I think that might be to overstate things. And perhaps the best thing to say is simply this, that if you are a Christian, if you're going to be a Christian, you're going to live out your life as a Christian, well then the honor will not be yours. The honor won't be yours, for the Lord will deliver. It's God who will do it. He'll work out his purposes so that he is glorified and not you. So I don't know what you think, what is the best way to understand that, but keep it in mind Hebrews chapter 11. I think that probably is the way to understand it. This is not a time for you to get glory for yourself, Barak. That's not going to happen. It's not going to be for you then, the glory. And I think you can extrapolate and say, well, if you get involved in any Christian work, because it is a temptation, isn't it? You say, well, I want to be a preacher. And I want to be a preacher with a big church and lots of people, and everybody says, oh, what a fine preacher he is. And it doesn't always work out that way. And even if it does work out that way, sometimes God has other ways of humbling such a person along the way. And so I think we ought to at least say that then, that if we're going to do it in a Christian way, the honor will not be ours. The Lord will deliver. I think that's probably the best way to think about that passage. And then the fourth thing here is to consider God's providence and to learn how this enemy was destroyed, and really to be expectant on the basis of that. So from verse 9 then we come to the denouement of the whole thing. Deborah willingly goes with Barak then to Kadesh. And there we learn, verse 10, that Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. And so 10,000 men went up under his command. And Deborah, of course, as we said, she was also with him. And then we get, I suppose in a modern book, verse 11 would be down in a sort of footnote, really. Now Heber, the Kenite, had left the other Kenites. These are the descendants of Hobab, Moses' brother-in-law, and pitched his tent by the great tree in Za'ananim, near Kadesh. So he wasn't very far from Kadesh. And it does seem a little bit irrelevant at this point, a bit out of place. Why are you telling us this? Why would this be important for me to know? But what it is doing, of course, is alerting us to a providence of God. It went back some years. All this happened a little while before, but it was something that was going to lead in its own way to what we read about in the rest of the chapter. And it's a reminder never to forget the providence of God. God is always doing things and bringing things about them. And sometimes in quite surprising ways, God is working to bring about his will. And so we read in verse 12 to 15 then a brief account of the battle It was somewhere on the plain of Esdraelon. When they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera summoned then from Harosheth Hagoyim to the Kishon River all his men, and these 900 chariots that he had, all iron-fitted chariots. And so Deborah says to Barak, "Go. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you?" And so Barak went down Mount Tabor with his 10,000 men following him. And at Barak's advance then, and this is the important thing again, the Lord, he routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword. So it was the Lord who did it. And we mustn't miss that emphasis then. This is the day the Lord has given Sisera into your hands, Deborah says. Has not the Lord gone ahead of you? And like a mighty warrior then, God leads his army to victory. And at Barak's advance then, we read the Lord routed Sisera. You wonder, well, how did he do it? How did he win that battle? Now, I think it's in chapter 5 that you get the answer to that question. It would seem that there was a great storm there that God sent, and the Kishon River was sent into flood. And, well, chariots are very good, aren't they? But once they get bogged down in the mud, they're not very good at all. There's an eyewitness says that in that part of the world, he saw in 15 minutes, when the rain came down, the whole place was turned to a bog. And I think that's what happened. And then we read about Sisera, how he got down from his chariot. He got out of his chariot because the chariot was no good. It wouldn't move. And you've had the experience perhaps with your car where you've just had to abandon it and get out. It's not going to go any further. And that's what happened to Sisera. And so Barak pursued the chariots that were able to move and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. And all Sisera's troops then fell by the sword. There wasn't a man left. Sisera, meanwhile, then, he fled on foot to the tent of this woman, Jael. And here we are told that she was the wife of Heber the Kenite. So the footnote begins to be relevant at this point. And the reason Sisera comes here then is because there was this alliance between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the family of Heber the Kenite. And so we read how Jael goes out to meet Sisera. She says, come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid. And so he enters her tent, and he's tired, he's exhausted, and he wants to lie down. So he lies down, and she covers him with a blanket. And then he says to her that he's thirsty. "Please give me some water," he says. Now, I don't know if she didn't have any water there at the time, but she opened a skin of milk, she gave him a drink, and then she covered him up again. And then he says to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent. If someone comes by and asks you, 'Is anyone there?' say no, say no." So she knew he was on the run. She knew he was trying to escape. So far, so good for Sisera. He's safe. But then in verse 21, we read that Jael, Heber's wife then, she picked up a tent peg and a hammer. Apparently, in those cultures then, those nomadic cultures, it's the women that put the tents up. I think in our culture, it's the men that put the tents up, but I've never had to do it, so I don't know. And she went then very quietly to this man while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. And he must have been lying on his side. You know, this is the temple, isn't it? It's quite a soft part of the skin, of the head. And so she drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and understandably, he died. So it's again pretty gruesome, isn't it? We had this dagger or sword plunged into the fat king's belly, the handle disappearing into the flesh. It's pretty gruesome, and this is pretty gruesome as well. This time it's a tent peg going through a man's head. We read finally how Barak comes by in pursuit of Sisera, and so Jael is able to go out to meet him, and she says, "Come." Because she's, you know, she knows exactly what's going on here. "I will show you the man you're looking for." And so he went in with her, and there lay Sisera with the tent peg through his temple, dead. So it's treachery, isn't it? Sisera has been betrayed. But it is really the turning point of the whole story. And the truth is then that on that day God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, before the Israelites. The hand of the Israelites pressed harder and harder against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they destroyed him. Now in the next chapter, Jael is celebrated. And you may feel a bit uneasy about this. You may say, well, I don't really want a hero like Jael. Deborah is okay. Deborah the judge, and perhaps Barak, I don't know. But this Gentile woman with a hammer and an unflinching willingness to put a man to death. Maybe we're not quite so easy with that. But I think you've got to remember who Sisera was. Sisera then was a man who oppressed the people of God. Sisera was the sort of man, it would seem, if you read chapter 5, who thought nothing of raping a girl in the midst of battle. Two girls in the midst of battle. And I don't think we should spare any tears for Sisera whatsoever. God brings about his salvation then in the ways that he pleases. And Jael made the right choice. She was put to a choice at this point, wasn't she? She's either going to side with the Canaanites, with whom her family were in alliance, or she's going to side with the people of God. And she made the right choice. She made the choice to side with the people of God, with Israel. She chose the better part, and it's not to be taken from her. And so she's an example to us. It's just not easy, is it, to put sin to death and to deal ruthlessly with our sins. But that's what we've got to do. That's the way we've got to go about it as we look to the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.